You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the CDC recently recommended that Americans use face masks in public, a reversal from their earlier guidance that they weren't necessary for most people. We'll find out why and if they're catching on here in Wisconsin. By the way, we're in our spring member drive. WPR makes a difference in your day. It keeps you connected with news and culture from nearby and far away. Members, people like you, make up the biggest share of WPR funding. Make a gift today for programs that you count on, programs like Central Time. You can give now at 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552 or online at WPR.org. And thanks. Now, a leading model used by the White House to predict the number of COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. has been revised downward. The model from the University of Washington now projects about 60,000 deaths by early August. Last week, it was saying about 82,000. It also shows the U.S. peaking this past weekend. But some other models continue to suggest we've got a longer way to go. For example, a model in Washington, D.C. has the nation peaking at the end of June. Others show the U.S. should prepare for up to 200,000 deaths in the coming months. So why do these models vary so much, and what conclusions should we draw from them? Ali Mokhtad is director of Middle Eastern Initiatives and a professor of global health at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. He also works on the Institute's COVID-19 model. Ali, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Why did we see this significant revision downward over the last weekend?
So what we have seen right now, that previous experience in both Italy and Spain have showed that the virus is not peaking as much, and reduction on it is coming faster. So it goes faster and comes down faster. And that ended up in revising our estimate. And right now we are about 70,000 deaths by August 4th.
Now let's talk about how predicting something like this, the course of a disease, differs from predicting something like, say, the weather. If it's going to rain tomorrow, it's going to rain no matter what I do. But with the spread of a disease, it seems like by taking public measures, our own individual behavior can actually change things and make us revise our models. How do you take account for policy changes in human behavior when you do these models?
That's a very good point, Rob. That's exactly what we did in our models. Other models have estimated that the virus will be spreading without countermeasures. In our models, we included variables for social distancing, such as staying at home, educational facility closing, and non-essential services closed. And we adjust our model on a daily basis. Now we're releasing them 3 times a week. So we are assuming that there is a virus spreading around in the community, but people and authorities are doing something to contain it. And that's why our numbers have been lower than other people.
Now, let's talk about the model for when this peaks. Last I saw, your model had the peak over the last weekend. What does that mean, first of all, when we say the virus is peaking at a particular time?
So the virus is peaking and the burden is peaking and peaked in our models April 10. And that's good news. It means that the worst is behind us. And from now on, the number of deaths will decrease on a daily basis. We'll have, as a country, more deaths, of course. And that's a big loss for a lot of people, loved one and friends and family. But it means that the pandemic is being controlled and it's coming down, less demand on our health facilities. But Rob, there is two things here that we need to pay attention on. The first one is that peak is a national peak. But we are seeing right now that states who have implemented the social distancing measures early on have a peak much earlier, like my state peaked, Washington peaked on April 5, New York peaked on April 8, whereas states like Georgia, Florida, Connecticut, they will peak at the end of April or 1st of May. And now we have two kind of epidemic curves. One will go down to what we consider as normal sometimes in the first week of May, and one will go down, these late adopters of these policies, at the late on first week of June.
Can we say from what you're saying about the models, Ali, and how they correspond with safe at home measures or stay at home measures, whatever they're called in a particular state or country, that these things are working? They're actually bending the curve, flattening the curve the way we've hoped they would?
They are working. And actually, in our models, we assume that the state who haven't implemented them will do so in 1 week. And every time we release a new model, that's why you see an increase in the number of deaths right now, because some of these states have not adopted them, and mortality rate increases are much higher in them than in the states that have adopted them. So we have data right now from the United States showing they are working, and that's why you're seeing this divergence in the curve of the epidemic between these states right now.
We're talking to Ali Mokhtad from the University of Washington. He works, among other things, on the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation there, a very commonly cited model of the coronavirus progression used, among other things, by the White House to try to get a handle on how the disease is spreading and how efforts are working. Ali, is it possible that if we change our behavior again, say by going back to normal, you'd have to revise your projections in the other direction, that we could, by our choices, make things worse potentially?
That's very true, unfortunately, because we're all susceptible for this virus and it's still circulating out there. We have to be very careful. Remember, all of us paid a heavy sacrifice in our economy and staying at home, and some of us paid even a higher price by losing their lives, so we cannot relax right now. But at the same time, Rob, we have to be realistic and we have to figure out ways to open up the society again and open up our businesses. But we have to do it in a waves and phased approach, make sure the people that we ask to go to work, we can test them before they go out and make sure we can monitor them as they are working and slowly go back to what we call normal. Our normal will be different than the usual normal you and I knew before COVID-19.
Now, Ali, you've got a lot of lay people, not experts, you know, people like me, all of a sudden really interested in your model, and we see your model and other models and different numbers coming out. What do you suggest for those of us without this specific expertise, when we see numbers cited in a newspaper report or whatever, how should we think of these models? What can we do with them?
That's a very good question, and I've been asked this a lot. Rob, you know, we are academic and we may have an agreement or disagreement about a model, how you should do it. But all these models right now are telling us exactly the same thing, that this is a deadly virus. It's circulating and all of us are susceptible. And all what we have right now, until we have a vaccine or a drug for it, social distancing is what we have as a way to reduce its burden. So I will tell people, irrespective of the number out there, and I'm one, you know, be honestly, I'll tell you my model is better than any other model, but that's not the issue here. The issue here is the message coming from these models. Please stay at home, reduce the burden on your medical system. Give us some time to have the tests that we need in order to reintroduce some of you to go to business and expand that while we can monitor the situation and make sure we don't have setbacks after all what we sacrificed.
Ali, comparing one disease to another, what has been unique about the novel coronavirus that causes COVID-19 as compared to other diseases we've tried to model the progress of in the past?
This is a new virus, of course, so we haven't seen it. There is no article I could go to and figure out how it behaved before. So we're learning, unfortunately, as we go, and we're relying on experience coming from countries who faced this burden before us, China, Italy, Spain, and so on. This virus is similar to what we have seen in the Spanish flu. It was introduced and nobody knew about it, and it was the first time we faced it. So we have to be extra careful because we don't have a vaccine again and we don't have a drug. And we don't know right now, like we found out later, that people who are asymptomatic have the virus and can be contagious. We know that some people right now have minor symptoms in a flu season and in a season of allergy. Some people will not seek medical care right now, but they still have the virus. So we have to be extra cautious. We're learning as we go. We're taking a cautious approach to it, which is the sound approach. But at the same time, I want the listeners to know that we in the public health, we're concerned about the economy and we're putting blueprints ahead in order to open the business. But please, we're not ready yet. We will be ready soon. There is light at the end of the tunnel.
And before I let you go, Ali, this sounds like a really challenging job right now. You're constantly finding new information about this disease that for humans is what, 5 months old or so now. So you're constantly updating your model, I imagine, based on new data from the country and around the world.
Yes, we are. And at the Institute for Health Metric and Evaluation, we have a large network of collaborators, over 5,000 scientific collaborators out there. So we're getting a lot of data, and with more data, our model gets better. We wish we have more data, but we're working with what we have, and we're trying to produce the best estimates so we can make decisions and policy based on the best data we have. And that's why we're updating these models on a regular basis, giving the new data coming to us.
Ali, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye.
Ali Mokhtad is a professor at the University of Washington who's been working on the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation's COVID-19 model. We talked to him about how infectious disease modeling works and why the model he works on recently lowered its COVID-19 death projections. Coming up, we'll talk about what you need to know about face masks in the fight against the coronavirus and how Wisconsin has responded to a spike in demand for them. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump says he's cutting funding for the World Health Organization. We'll check out that story and more in our weekly roundup of the top news in national politics. By the way, you count on WPR for high-quality news, conversations, and music that keep you informed and connected. During our spring member drive, we have you covered, and you can have your feet covered. Support the programs you rely on and ask for your cozy new WPR socks when you give $10 a month. Find out how. Give at 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552, or give online at WPR.org. And thank you. Now, if you've been outside recently, you've probably noticed more people wearing face masks. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently updated their guidance on masks, recommending non-medical grade cloth masks when people are in public places. Our colleagues at WisContext recently took a closer look at why the CDC made that change and broke down what you need to know. Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisContext. Will, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Can you tell us a little more about this change in guidance from the CDC?
Yeah, the change in guidance came almost 2 weeks ago now, on April 3rd. Prior to that, the CDC had been recommending that healthy people, so people without respiratory symptoms, go without face masks in almost all situations. The one situation that they did recommend face masks for healthy people was if they were a caregiver for someone with COVID-19. As I just mentioned, on April 3rd, they changed that guidance to allow for the voluntary use of cloth face masks in public where social distancing is kind of impossible or hard to manage. So that would be like grocery stores or pharmacies, et cetera. And so this is just a recommendation. It's not anything more than that, but it's something I think that they changed to give people a little bit of guidance.
And a couple of states around the country, just in the news today, are adding new requirements for face masks. But the CDC change of decision, first of all, what led to some of their reluctance to want to give this guidance? I understand it has in part to do with the supply of masks, medical type masks, for the people who really, really need them.
Exactly. I think that was a big part of the reason why the CDC was so reticent in changing that guidance for so long. It had been talked about for some time, and as we have seen in the news, in many parts of the world, particularly in Asia, face mask use is quite common when a respiratory disease is circulating, and a lot of imagery from China, Japan, South Korea demonstrated that. But I think that you're right, that the CDC was really quite nervous, as I think all medical professionals and public health officials in the nation have been, about a run on medical grade masks. So that would be disposable surgical masks or those N95 respirators, which keep about 95% of microscopic particles out of your respiratory system.
And so the recommendation now is don't go out and try to get your hands public on these masks, but we're seeing more and more guidelines and models of cloth masks. And as you write in your piece, there's been a boom in crafters and others making these things for people to use in their daily lives. Can you talk about what we've seen in the state?
Yeah, I interviewed a couple organizers of this Facebook group. It's called the Wisconsin Face Mask Warriors. And they just got started in late March, I think like March 22nd or something, with only a couple hundred volunteers. That effort has since ballooned to more than 4,000 volunteers. And actually, that was at the end of last week. So it's quite possibly much higher than that at this point. But a good portion of those volunteers are sewing cloth face masks that adhere pretty closely to the CDC's guidelines. So that would be multiple layers of washable cloth. In this case, they're using cotton with elastic bands that you can wrap around your ears. So they fit nice and snug around your mouth and your nose. And they also are compatible with autoclave systems. So those are the systems at hospitals and other medical facilities that clean materials under high pressure and high temperature and sanitize them. And they've seen a huge spike in demand from not only medical facilities that are running short on medical grade masks and just looking for any type of mask to protect their workers, but also from, since the CDC changed its guidance in early April, from a growing number of just regular folks looking for masks.
We're talking to Will Cushman, associate editor of WIS Context, about masks. The CDC recently changed guidelines to recommend wearing some kind of cloth mask in public for otherwise apparently healthy people. And Will, in your piece, you talk about kind of a change in mindset about how people think about masks. I think the initial thought is if I'm wearing a mask, it's to protect me. But actually, it sounds like when we wear masks, we're maybe protecting everybody else around us. Can you talk about the difference there?
Yes, for sure. And that's a really, really important part of this. So I think the CDC was nervous about people buying up medical masks, but they also, up until April, really wasn't a whole lot of evidence, and there remains not much evidence supporting the notion that widespread use of face masks in public can slow the spread of COVID-19. What has changed in terms of kind of clinical evidence is a much firmer understanding now of the large number of people who may be infected with the novel coronavirus, but who may not be showing symptoms, so asymptomatic people, or people who will go on to develop symptoms, but are not showing symptoms at the moment, pre-symptomatic, but are still carrying a high viral load in their systems and potentially able to be contagious and infect other people. So really, that's kind of the other half of the equation, or the other part of why the CDC decided to shift its guidance was because of this better understanding of asymptomatic and pre-symptomatic infection, and hoping that people wearing masks will hopefully keep asymptomatic carriers of the virus from more readily spreading the virus when they're out in public grocery shopping or at the pharmacy.
And another message, Will, from some of the public health experts you talked to for this piece was, to sum it up, masks aren't magic. Just because we're wearing a mask doesn't excuse us from the other social distancing things, from the hand washing everybody's telling us to do. Masks might help, but they're not the be-all and end-all.
Exactly. And that's what I talked to a couple medical professionals and public health officials in Wisconsin, and they were very, very adamant that face masks are not a stand-in for proper hygiene, so proper hand washing and respiratory etiquette, covering your cough and sneeze, and especially not a stand-in for social distancing. They said that those strategies are proven and are effective and are working. And face masks, the use of face masks in public is not really proven to help slow the spread of a respiratory disease like COVID-19.
And Will, you mentioned the culture. Some countries are more used to a lot of people putting on masks in the midst of an outbreak like this. We live, I think it's fair to say, in one that doesn't. After the CDC guidelines, I didn't have a mask yet. I did the bandana trick. First time I've done that, I think, since like a third grade Halloween costume. I felt kind of silly, but I did it. What do you think about the sort of the cultural pickup here in Wisconsin when it comes to masks?
Totally, and that was another thing that when I talked to people A lot of people talked about that, the fact that, maybe there is a cultural shift happening in the U.S. right now, where people are more comfortable wearing masks in public. That certainly wasn't the case, as you just mentioned, and I can speak to that myself personally. I felt kind of strange the first time I went to the pharmacy to pick up some stuff wearing a face mask. And some of the folks I spoke to who have started wearing face masks all over Wisconsin mentioned the same thing. But on the flip side, I talked to someone, a woman up in Spooner, who said that she's actually now feeling kind of peer or social pressure to wear a mask because she's noticed that when she goes to the grocery store in Spooner now, that most of the people there are wearing masks. And even though she wasn't really convinced that she should wear one based on the science, she said that she now is doing it kind of to go along with what she's seeing her peers doing.
So what are you watching for next, Will, when it comes to supply and demand of masks here in the state?
Yeah, I'm really interested to see if the state will be able to secure more medical face masks and other personal protective equipment. That is something that the state has been struggling with. I spoke to Dr. Ryan Westergaard, the state epidemiologist, for the story, and he said that being able to secure PPE is still the highest need for the state right now. So we'll be watching to see if that happens soon.
Well, thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Will Cushman, associate editor of WisContext. He was with us today to talk about his latest story on the changing guidance on face masks and how Wisconsin is picking up on them. You can find all the details online over at wiscontext.org. Listener support is the largest source of funding for Wisconsin Public Radio and services like WisContext. That is a big deal this spring member drive. You can support the programs you value and all the great things we do online at WPR.org, at the WisContext website, and more. You can make a gift right now at 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552. Or go online, takes just a few minutes, and give at our website, WPR.org, to make a contribution to support Central Time and all your other favorite programs. And thank you so much for your gift. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about President Trump's apparently strained relationship with Dr. Anthony Fauci and other top stories in national news. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, laugh with us. We'll explore the physical and mental health benefits of intentional laughter with the doctor known as the guru of giggling. Listener support is the largest source of funding for Wisconsin Public Radio. That's powerful. This spring, member drive. Support the programs you value. Give now. Call 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552. Or go online at WPR.org. And thank you. Now, former Vice President Joe Biden picked up a couple big endorsements this week as the presumptive Democratic nominee for president. And then there's been a lot of back and forth at the national level about the novel coronavirus and the federal approach to it. We'll tackle those issues and more in this week's look at the latest news in national politics. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the response you've seen from the federal government and the states when it comes to novel coronavirus, about President Trump's tweets and statements about infectious diseases expert Anthony Fauci, and the announcement of a cut in funding for the World Health Organization, and the daily briefings from the president and his team? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tolu Olorunipa is a Washington Post White House reporter. Tolu, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Well, another busy week in national news. We started the week with speculation that President Trump was considering ousting National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases Director Dr. Anthony Fauci. Remind us of what led up to last weekend and what the president had said on Twitter that got people's attention.
Yeah, that feels like it was so long ago. But
I know,
was only,
this is Wednesday.
Right, that was just a few days ago that President Trump took to Twitter and he retweeted one of his supporters who posted an attack on Anthony Fauci, the top infectious disease expert in the federal government, someone who's been on the coronavirus task force and been at President Trump's side over the past few weeks as he's tried to navigate this outbreak and this pandemic. Dr. Fauci spent some time on television on Sunday, and he basically admitted that if the government had acted earlier, if the federal government had acted sooner, then many more lives would have been saved in this process. If social distancing had been put in place earlier, that lives would have been saved. And that caused some of President Trump's supporters to attack Fauci and say that he was undermining the president. And this whole Fire Fauci movement began. And President Trump retweeted one of his supporters who not only criticized Fauci's media appearance, but also included the hashtag Fire Fauci. And that caused a lot of questions about whether or not President Trump was about to get rid of Dr. Fauci, who has been sort of a well-trusted advisor to presidents going all the way back to Reagan. He's been a top official when it comes to pandemics and infectious diseases. And there was a lot of concern on both sides of the aisle that President Trump may have been ready to get rid of him. But President Trump eventually was asked about his retweet and just said, you know, I like a little bit of controversy. I don't necessarily agree with everyone that I retweet. And he said that he continues to have faith and support for Dr. Fauci and that he had no plans to fire him. That was the story as of Monday. On Tuesday, we did not see Dr. Fauci at the White House press briefing. There's another press briefing scheduled for today. We'll see what happens. But it is very interesting that that became a storyline over the weekend and into the early part of this week, with President Trump sort of fanning the flames of controversy about whether he would get rid of the top leader when it comes to infectious diseases in the federal government.
Yeah, let's give a listen to President Trump, as you said, on Monday, addressing that question about it. Here is a listen.
Today I walk in, I hear I'm going to fire him. I'm not firing him. I think he's a wonderful guy.
Why did you tweet something that said fire Fauci?
I retweeted somebody. I don't know. They said fire. Doesn't matter.
So I guess a lesson in how to read or not read a tweet from the president, I guess. Even though his retweet included the words fire Fauci, he says not a significant statement.
Right. He said, you know, sometimes he retweets people who he does not agree with. He's not necessarily endorsing their point of view. It is very interesting because that tweet did not get that much traction before President Trump tweeted it to his 79 million followers. So if he doesn't agree with something, why he would be amplifying it to almost 80 million people is definitely a questionable strategy. But he did go into the briefing room and essentially just pretended to have no idea what this was all about and said, you know, I am not going to fire this guy. I don't know why people are asking me about this. Even though he was the one who tweeted out and elevated this tweet, basically saying that Fauci should be fired. So this is another instance of the president adding more controversy to what is already a very controversial response to this pandemic. A lot of questions about how his administration has handled things. But just to add to the drama, the president sort of caused some speculation that he may be willing to fire Fauci. It seems like for now that speculation has died down, but We'll have to wait and see. Every day is another episode in the Trump show.
Tolu Olorunipa is with us from the Washington Post, looking at the latest news in national politics. Now, yesterday, President Trump announced that he's going to halt U.S. funding for the World Health Organization, the WHO. What was his reasoning behind that, as he stated?
Well, the president said that he did not like how the WHO has handled this pandemic from the outset. He said he disagreed with some of the statements that have come out of the WHO, including criticism of the ban that President Trump implemented on travel from China for most travelers coming into the United States from China. The president's ban was unpopular with some of the leadership at the WHO. And the president also said that the WHO was too China-centric centric, that the organization had focused too much on defending China and promoting the views of China and not so much on sort of supporting its mission. He complained about the millions of dollars that the United States spends every year on funding the WHO as a lead sponsor for the group and saying that other countries are not spending enough. Part of the president's sort of longstanding disagreement with the way international bodies are funded, the burden that the United States pays, whether it's the WTO, the World Trade Organization, the United Nations, a lot of international bodies, NATO. President Trump has not been happy with the way the burdens are shared, with the United States often paying the bulk. And a lot of critics for the president say that this is an instance of the president trying to shift blame, that he also was praising China and talking about China's transparency back in January, and now he's criticizing the WHO for doing the same thing, that he's blaming the WHO for not giving him an adequate heads up on this virus, and others are saying that the president had plenty of time to take action, but he wanted to downplay the virus. He was thinking about the stock market. He did not want people to be panicking, and for that reason, he delayed his own response and was not taking significant action until mid-March. And, you know, he lost several weeks when he could have saved lives. So a lot of his critics are saying that he's using this as a scapegoat, and he's attacking the WHO in part because of the very clear substandard response of the federal government that has led to thousands of deaths.
World Health Organization Director Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus condemned the move by Trump and said the WHO would be reviewing its own response to the pandemic. Here's a little bit of what he had to say.
When we're divided, the virus exploits the cracks between us. We're committed to serving the world's people and to accountability for the resources with which we're entrusted.
What's response been like domestically, Tulu, to the announcement of a cut in funding?
Well, we've heard Democrats really apoplectic over this. They've attacked the president. They criticized him. They've said this is actually illegal, that this funding was appropriated by Congress and the president can't just decide to hold it back. Some people have made comparisons to the Ukraine funding that the president held back in 2018 and eventually was impeached over. You know, we've heard some Republicans defend the president, say that the WHO does need to be reined in, that they have been too China friendly, and that they do need to be reviewed for what they've done. And the president's defenders have said that he's in, you know, in his authority to decide whether or not to spend taxpayer dollars on a group that is not pursuing the interests of the United States. So it has broken down along partisan lines, essentially Democrats saying that this was a bad move and potentially an illegal move by the president, Republicans defending the president and saying that he is right to question whether the WHO is fulfilling its mandate. But there is some concern that cutting off this funding in the middle of a pandemic may not be the most strategic move. This is a group and an organization that the world relies on to supply important information and supplies and response, to coordinate a global response to a pandemic that is not really spared any country. And a lot of the concern domestically is that this is maybe not the right time to be suspending this money, even if a review takes place. By suspending this money, they could be crippling the WHO at a time when this is the world's leading body for combating this pandemic. And there's not yet clear what it would do to cut off funding for this group at a time when they're trying to fight against the pandemic that has really crippled countries around the world.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in West Salem. Jeff, hello.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a few comments. You know, I voted Republican in the past, and I voted Democrat. I'm more, you know, later on in my life, more liberal and Democrat now. But it's getting to a point, some of these policies are costing people's lives. I mean, you're going to cut $500 million, like your guest said, from the WHO. That's going to cost people's lives. I don't care how you turn around. It's because he's petty, because they criticized his Chinese ban that – you can't criticize a guy, and he makes one statement one day, like, I'm the absolute ruler, I have all power over all these states, and then the next day he goes back on it. It's just crazy. It's just from in the beginning he could have acted and saved lives, but he went golfing instead in March and January, whatever. And then he's delaying these checks because he wants his signature on them. It's just amazing.
Jeff, thanks for the call. You're giving us a lot to work with there. We'll get into President Trump and the governor's issue in just a bit, Tolu. But for the base part of what Jeff is saying there, this is something that probably we're going to be arguing about a lot now and maybe right up until people start voting in the November elections. Is how big a political issue is this going to be, Tolu?
This is going to be a huge political issue. This is the defining issue right now for the campaign, and that's part of the reason you see President Trump out there on a daily basis, holding these daily press briefings, speaking directly to the American people. He can't be out at rallies, so he's using this response to try to make the case for his election. Now, Democrats and his opponents will say he's making the case against his reelection because he's made a lot of missteps. And as the caller said, he's not been consistent with his messaging. There's been times where he said he is the ultimate, you know, decider, and he has the full authority. There have been other times where he said this is on the governors and the local officials should be taking the lead role. And he has not been so consistent with how he's responded to this. He said he's downplayed the pandemic and said this is just the flu. This is all going to go away miraculously with the warmer weather. And then he said that we need to have 30 days of social distancing and everyone staying at home. So he has opened himself up to a lot of criticism. But at the same time, and we saw the president basically stage a campaign commercial during one of these press briefings earlier this week. He's trying to use it to show his leadership skills, to show how much he's doing by sending hospital ships to the states that need them, getting more ventilators made, sending millions of masks across the country to hospitals. He's really trying to show that he has used the full force of the federal government to respond to this, what he calls an invisible enemy, and he's called himself a wartime president. He's going to use that to try to get the country to rally around him, and we'll have to wait and see in November whether it works, but it's clear that there is a lot of politics at play, and the president is really trying to use this to bolster his reelection bid.
We're talking to Tolu Olorunipa of The Washington Post about some of the week's top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the federal and state responses to the coronavirus pandemic. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Washington Post White House reporter Tolu Olorunipa about some of the top stories out of Washington this week, including the handling of the pandemic. Let's go back to your calls now. Mark is on the line in Kimberly. Mark, hi.
Hi. You understand why Donald Trump does this. He's bringing up hydroxy drug he's promoting, but back to your issue. In May of 2018, Trump administration dismantled some government units that were, specifically targeting pandemics, and one was within the National Security Council, something called the Global Health Security Unit, and then within the Department of Homeland Security, they had some kind of epidemiological team, and there was another unit within the CDC.
I gotcha, and Mark. Thanks a lot for that call. That we don't have a ton of time left. I want to throw this to Tolu that there have been people pointing out these reorganizations. I think the White House called them at the time. People saying, well, that weakened some of our top line pandemic response. What's the word on that, Tolu?
Yeah, this is a sore spot for the administration because they did disband what had been a part of the National Security Council that was really in charge of preparing for a pandemic like this and making sure that the country would be in the best possible position if we were to be hit with what we're facing now, which is a global pandemic, which has the possibility of taking tens of thousands of American lives. And President Trump has been asked about this, and he has basically said that he did not know about it, and it hasn't really been a shining light for his administration. The idea that a lot of the things that have happened, whether or not it's the inability to get ventilators made, the concern that PPE, this personal protective equipment that hospitals need, was in short supply, that the National Strategic Stockpile did not have what it needed for all of the various states that were really fearful that they were going to run out of key equipment. These are the kinds of things that you would expect the National Security Council to prepare for. And a lot of this caught the administration flat-footed, and they've been playing catch-up ever since, even with testing, not being able to have enough tests to determine the spread of the disease. And that's been a major challenge for the administration throughout this crisis. And it's been something that's been a political weakness for the president as well, because we have seen the president's opponents bring up the fact that he has seemed ill-prepared for the moment, and he has seemed to not have everything that was needed, and his desire to really campaign against government and government expertise and the so-called deep state has caused him not to listen to the experts that could lead him in the right direction on this. So it is a weak spot for the president. It's something that the administration is trying to prepare for, but it has been a challenge for the president since he was responsible for getting rid of the group that would have normally prepared for something like this.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Tolu Olorunipa from The Washington Post, looking at the latest news in national politics. Now, usually April of an election year, Tolu, on this segment, most of our folks would be on the presidential race, which is still going on now. And now Joe Biden stands effectively alone as a candidate, and we've seen a few big endorsements over the last week. Can you talk about the key big names in the Democratic Party coming forward to try to give, a show of party unity here?
Yes, Biden has been in his basement, essentially. He has not been able to campaign. He's been doing these live televised and video briefings and whatnot. But he has had a really strong bump for his campaign over the last week. We saw Bernie Sanders, his chief political rival on the Democratic side, endorse him. He stepped aside and he provided his endorsement for Joe Biden this week. And then we saw former President Barack Obama, who had been basically keeping his powder dry and not weighing in on the Democratic primary, came out and endorsed Joe Biden with a 12 or 13 minute video basically praising Biden for what he had done during the Obama administration and talking about why he chose him as the vice president and all that he was able to accomplish and all that he hopes that he will be able to accomplish as president, and the need for essentially getting rid of President Trump and returning to a politics that is more based on empathy and good governance and expertise and less on meanness and pettiness. Joe Biden did get a pretty strong endorsement, and he also got an endorsement from Elizabeth Warren today. So he is really rolling in really strong endorsements. He has not been able to sort of showcase those the traditional way by appearing somewhere in front of a big crowd with his endorsers, with these heavy hitters in the Democratic Party because of the coronavirus and the need for social distancing. But he's tried to make the most out of it by having these people that are highly admired on the Democratic side, President Obama, Bernie Sanders among his left-leaning camp, Elizabeth Warren to an extent among progressives and college-educated voters, and having them come out and endorse him so strongly so early in the Democratic primary has been a benefit to his campaign. If you look back 4 years ago in 2016, Hillary Clinton was not able to get an endorsement from Bernie Sanders until July, shortly before the convention. And that really hampered her in trying to bring the party together, trying to bring together the wings of the party, bring over Bernie Sanders voters. The Democrats having rallied around Joe Biden this early could help him in trying to bring the party together. He still faces an uphill challenge in trying to get the Bernie voters on his side because they are so staunchly in support of more progressive ideas than what he's putting forward. But he has much more time now, and he's reaching out and trying to bring them over. And that is something that he can look forward to in the months ahead, the fact that he has sewn up the nomination and that he has the support from the various wings of the party, including a lot of the party's heavy hitters, all the way from President Obama through most of the Democratic field who ran against him last year and this year.
Very briefly, Tolu, as we run out of time, a day or two could seem like a long time lately. What's the story you're watching right now?
Well, one thing I'm watching is that the Washington Post reported earlier this morning that President Trump is going to be having his name on the stimulus checks that are going to be going out over the next several weeks. That is an unprecedented move for a president to sort of inject politics into this bipartisan stimulus program. So the idea that the president's name is going to be on these checks, it's going to cause a lot of recriminations. You're going to hear from Democrats saying that this is the wrong move. Republicans are going to have to defend this. There may be blowback because the checks may have to be delayed in order for the money to go out with the president's name on it. And that's something that could be very difficult for people having to wait an extra day or an extra week because they are struggling and trying to pay their bills. And this is something that could have a lot of political blowback. It could benefit the president eventually if people associate the $1,200 that they're getting with him and vote for him because of that.
And that's all the time we have. Thanks to our guest, Tolu Olorunipa from The Washington Post. He joins us today for our weekly look at some of the latest news in national politics, including the latest in efforts at the federal level against the spread of the novel coronavirus. Time for another check-in on the big competition that's got everyone's attention, pitting state against state. It's the U.S. Census Self-Response Rate Challenge. In the absence of actual competitive sports, I've been checking in from time to time to see how Wisconsin is stacking up against states around the country to see who's doing the best at filling out and returning census forms. Now, Wisconsin had the lead at one point, but as I mentioned in the last check-in, Minnesota had inched ahead. And now our neighbors to the west are gaining some distance on us. Minnesota checks in today at 58.8%, while Wisconsin lags behind at 55.4%. That's a full 3 percentage points plus for Minnesota's lead. On the map, they even have their own color. They stand alone in their category. And we're not even secure at second place now. Michigan and Iowa are effectively tied with us. And Nebraska, they used to be in first place. They're just inches behind us now. By the way, the census even breaks it down by county and municipality. Waukesha and Washington counties are tied for the top spot in Wisconsin right now. And Howard's Grove in Sheboygan County leads cities and villages with a whopping 77.9% response rate. This information is provided for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not intended for use in making illegal wagers. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.